Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says that the Islamic Republic will return to its nuclear commitments only if the U.S. lifts all the sanctions first. Iran holds a ceremony to launch the clinical trial of its second domestically made coronavirus vaccine. Palestinian rights groups say that Israeli forces arrested more than 450 people across the occupied West Bank in January. Good to have you with us. Starting with some comments by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, saying if the United States lifts all sanctions, Tehran will live up to its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal. Ayatollah Khamenei said that it is Iran that has the right to set conditions on the nuclear deal, as it has delivered on all its obligations under the accord. The leader added that Iran will return to its commitments after verifying that all sanctions have been practically lifted. He said this is Iran's definitive policy and the country won't drop the policy whatsoever. The leader stressed that the Islamic Republic won't listen to those, be it in the U.S. or in Europe, who talk nonsense with regard to sanctions. Ayatollah Khamenei made those comments in a meeting with Air Force personnel. Now, this is special coverage on the occasion. I'm joined by a couple of guests. We'll have Bera Grossman, international lawyer, who's joining us out of Bali. And we'll also have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of London. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Bali first. Bera, you're an international lawyer, and so you know better than anybody else. When there is a deal and one party leaves the deal, and it's a multilateral one, of course, they leave the deal, they reimpose unilateral sanctions, and now they're asking for Iran to take the first step. Is that logical?
Well, it's not only not logical, it's completely absurd. To be clear, there was pretty much universal agreement that at all relevant times, Iran was in full compliance with the JCPOA. It was also pretty much universally accepted that the United States, when it opted out of the JCPOA, it had no basis for doing so, and therefore its opting out was itself a breach of the JCPOA. And of course, the unilateral sanctions which it subsequently imposed and essentially lobbied the rest of the world to accept are themselves squarely a breach of the terms and conditions of the JCPOA. Now, all of this brings up what I think is a relatively obvious point, namely that the JCPOA was in fact never really about Atlantic world concerns regarding an Iranian nuclear weapons program, bearing in mind that all 17 agencies comprising the intelligence apparatus in the United States had for pretty much a decade leading up to the JCPOA, each individually briefed Congress in classified sessions, saying that Iran didn't have a nuclear weapons program, had not made a political decision to start one at any time in the future, and that should Iran break out, it would certainly be caught out and stopped before a deliverable weapon could be produced. So I think the starting point here is that neither the JCPOA nor the position that's now being taken by Atlantic world nations, and I consider the United States and the European signatory nations to be equally complicit in this obvious breach, this illegal repudiation of the JCPOA. It's clear that this was not and is not about any genuine concern of Iran having a nuclear weapons program. The underlying concern is about resistance, about Iran's continuing resistance to submitting to Atlantic world governments, to Atlantic world social programs, to the recognition of Israel, and all manner of other policy matters which of course in a proper world are uniquely with matters for the sovereignty of the nation in question. So that's what it's about. The United States and other countries have made it perfectly clear that their concern is about Iran's perfectly legal missile program, that their concern is about Iran's refusal to recognize the legitimacy of Israel, and that their concern is about Iran's refusal to embrace Atlantic world foreign policy in the region, and so forth and so forth. Beside that, of course, we have the long-running program being pursued by the United States and its allies to introduce what they would call regime change in Iran. That's where the problem lies. Mm-hmm. It's the Atlantic world nations, it's the United States, the UK, France, Germany, and the EU itself, which have been in breach of the JCPOA. And quite frankly, it's very, very reasonable of Iran and to indicate a willingness, rather than simply repudiating the JCPOA, to indicate a willingness to give those nations an opportunity to correct their breach and get back to the program which they insisted right. on negotiating in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Now let me turn to London and ask Sayyid Mohsen Abbas what he thinks, because Mr. Abbas, as Barry also rightly mentioned, this is the opportunity that Iran is giving to the U.S. To make up its mind and see if it's going to return to if they want a return, they need to first do what they did to undo those sanctions they unilaterally imposed. Do you think that the Biden administration is serious? Because they were talking about this during the electoral campaign. Was that only publicity stunt, or did they really mean that?
I think it's been fairly clear. If you read into most of Biden's present team, who actually, by the way, are pretty much linked to the team that worked for Obama under John Kerry at that time when he was in office, they've given us all the indications of what the duplicity and of their coercive Iranian policy threats, basically. They were all out there, if you read between the lines. And it is really Biden team that wants to hold on to what it sees as the trump card, you know, the sanctions against Iran and its oil exports. And I think that their sort of narrow-minded, short-sighted obsession with economic sanctions as an absolute necessity, given the fact that they haven't worked, there's no sign that they're going to work, and the resilience of the Iranians has just simply increased, and the dislike and the exposure of the American imperialist policy has been exposed even more, and in fact hardened Iranian opinion against the JCPOA as well. You just have to say that Biden's policy is duplicitous at best, and that at worst, it's actually just a policy which is there to implement Israel's actual needs in West Asia, not the Americans' needs, because the Americans' public's needs are not going to be met by wasting more dollars and more American capital in West Asia on useless wars and useless confrontations which actually give them no economic advantage whatsoever. It's Israel. Let's bring Israel into the equation. It's Israel that is demanding that Iran's missile program be dismantled, as my colleague very succinctly outlined. It's Israel that wants Iran's regional influence to be diminished. What is that regional influence? It's the support of the likes of the Ansarullah, the oppressed people who are rising up against dictators and totalitarians in that region. Mm-hmm. It's helping the likes of Syria, who were attacked from all sides by the imperialist forces for resource purposes and geopolitical overtaking of that region. It's helping Iraq, which is on its knees after invasion upon invasion. This is the Iranian policy in the region, which irks Israel primarily, and America does through its lobbies in Congress, in the American political system, the bidding of the Israelis, and perhaps arguably also money power, because you know there are all sorts of other forces that are there also that actually quite make a lot of money out of all this weapons business, these nuclear arms. There is always a profit here in this, and it's usually the guys who are in the money lending or the money making business, the corporate transnational corporations. Biden serves those forces primarily. He does not serve the interests of the American people when he tries to play games around nuclear issues. The real issues, I think, were given very, very thoroughly prior to my narrative here. And I think people need to take focus of the root causes of what American policy is. Okay. And the Iranian people themselves and the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, the wise men and women in Iran, know full well that this is the case. They themselves internally have their debates going on a political level. To trust a wolf with sheep is probably quite an unwise policy. It's not something the Iranians will do. They will watch very carefully what Biden puts on the table. I don't think he's going to put anything significantly new on the table which will allow the JCPOA to be really readopted, mm-hmm. which puts the region under significant threat, major threat for more wars, more conflicts, and in fact pulls in the global economy at a time when it least needs it, with all of the effects of coronavirus and whatnot. It's certainly something that the world doesn't need, and the world should get involved and actually try to do its best not to comply with American sanctions, not to be cowed by American sanction fear, and be cut off the American lead on such a nonsensical world upsetting or destabilizing policies.
Okay, thank you very much for your contribution. Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joined us from Bali, and Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And that's it for this special coverage. Now let's move on with the rest of our broadcast. Iranian medical experts have begun the clinical trial of another indigenously developed coronavirus vaccine. Covapars is an inhalable vaccine developed using biotechnology. The tests of the vaccine have already been conducted successfully in animals, including guinea pigs, hamsters, and monkeys. The Covapars has been developed by the Razi Institute, a major medical research center in West Asia. The launch of human trials was announced in a ceremony in Tehran attended by experts and officials. Addressing the gathering, Health Minister Saeed Nemaki said that the achievement is a source of national pride.
One of the major jobs done over the past few months was to rely on domestically developed technology to produce a vaccine. The COVID-19 vaccine is not a simple one to develop, as the COVID-19 virus is a complex one. Producing a vaccine for it is a very complex process.
The minister added, it's not clear how effective the different vaccines developed by countries are, but they are the only way available to help contain the disease. Iran has developed another COVID-19 vaccine called Coviran, which is under the first human trial phase. Volunteers who received the shots have had no symptoms such as shock or fever after the injection. Masoud Soleimani, a vaccine trials expert at the Iran University of Medical Sciences, has provided us with some detail on the development process of the new Iran-made COVID vaccine.
So they created the vaccine about in March last year, end of February, March last year. And then from March, they started their animal testing first on mouse and hamster and rabbit. And then by almost end of May, June, they started testing it on monkeys. The green African monkey, which is very close to human race, they started testing on that monkey. And since then, until now, we have about 10 months of data which shows that this vaccine is safe, created no harm on these 23 monkeys that right now they are alive and well. And also they created a long-standing immune response, which what we need in an effective vaccine. Today, we had basically announcement of the start of the human phase of this vaccine. One of the innovations in this vaccine is that it consists of another third dose. The first dose is when you is in the form of inoculation, So the second, it comes about 3 weeks after the first dose. Again, it's an injection. And then it comes a month later, comes the nasal spray, which is an innovation, as I said, in this vaccine, because we have studies that shows that if the nasal IgA immune response becomes activated, then the person will not be spread the virus. Because one of the problems is that when you are immune against the virus, you don't get the virus, you are immune, you are healthy, but you may still spread the virus from nasal secretion.
Now, in other news, several Palestinian rights organizations have reported the arrest of more than 450 people in Israeli raids across the occupied West Bank in January. In a joint report, the organization's Prisoners Affairs Commission and the Palestinian Prisoner Society said that 93 minors and 8 women were among those detained last month. That reportedly brings the number of Palestinians in Israeli jails to some 4,500. Some of them are put under the regime's so-called administrative detention for up to 6 months without trial that's extended to unlimited periods. Palestinian rights groups have decried new detentions amid the COVID crisis. The report estimates over 350 Palestinian inmates have tested positive for COVID-19 in different Israeli jails due to regime's deliberate medical negligence. Rona Kendall says that the Palestinian inmates face a difficult situation in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them contracting the COVID-19.
They are being held in a very difficult situation in Israeli jails and military centers. This is, of course, is illegal according to the international laws, especially now with the spread of the coronavirus, this pandemic. The prisoners, many of them were infected by COVID-19. Over 360 Palestinians were captured this pandemic from the Israeli jailers and from the Israeli guards. And they are not isolated. They don't receive medical care. They continue to face medical negligence by the Israeli military.
Several Palestinian rights groups have praised the International Criminal Court for its decision to launch an investigation into Israeli war crimes in the occupied territories. In a joint statement, the groups Al-Haq Al-Nizan Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights called the ruling a landmark decision. They stressed that immediate action must be taken by the court to ensure justice and accountability for the victims. The ICC ruling says it has jurisdiction to investigate the situation in the Palestinian territories occupied by Israel in 1967, that's the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has rejected the ruling as pure anti-Semitism. And that's the end of this broadcast from Tehran.
Epic. Epic. Glory. Honor.
Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The capacities of the country are much more than the ones stated in our documents, writings, and speeches. Every corner of the country, including your Azerbaijan and Tabriz, this was correctly mentioned by the Honorable Friday Prayer Leader, is a sea of various economic, scientific, social, artistic, and other such capacities. Every place in the country is a sea of capacity. This year's 10-day Fajr ceremonies and this 22nd of Bahman are different, because after years of selfless efforts, the people see today that the echoes of their yell, their oppressed and powerful yell, can be heard clearly in other parts of the world of Islam. What I will say about a revolution, about the great event caused by the Iranian nation, which holds lessons for us, is primarily a picture of the realities of the world, so that we can see what the arrogant powers, the colonialists, the global bullies, and the hegemonic powers wanted and what really happened. So that we can see what they were looking for and what happened in reality. Then, I will point out two characteristics of our revolution which are related to our times.
Allah, Allah. La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 la ilaha illallah.
Regarding the first part, which is about presenting a picture of the current situation and comparing it to what the global bullies were looking for, I would like to say that the victors of the First and Second World Wars, mainly consisting of a few European countries and America, had a predetermined policy for the important Middle East region. This was because the Middle East is important in terms of its geopolitical position as a region that connects Asia, Europe and Africa together. It is also important in that its oil fields are among the biggest sources of oil in the world. Oil is vital for all industrial powers that have dominated the world. Moreover, in terms of its population, the Middle East region is home to ancient and deep-rooted nations. Therefore, they adopted a certain policy for this region.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah.
Praises to Allah.
Joe Biden has been inaugurated as the 46th president of the United States. Several of his cabinet appointees have also been confirmed by the Senate. So what have we learned so far from these confirmation hearings and his latest executive actions regarding both his domestic and foreign policy? Let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Roughly 1 year ago, Joe Biden's candidacy looked miserable and dead in the water. He was struggling to raise money for his presidential campaign from small dollar donations and had even tapped out all his wealthy Wall Street donors. His hopes of getting to the White House didn't look very promising at all. And yet here we are 1 year later, and Joe Biden has managed by some miracle to be elected the 46th president. We heard over and over warnings from the mainstream media and politicians alike how a progressive like Bernie Sanders just wasn't going to cut it against an existential threat like Donald Trump, and that it was imperative to get someone more moderate like Joe Biden into office, and that as soon as he got into the White House, everything would be fine. So now that he's the president, what has his first week in office looked like? Well, the mainstream media wasted no time celebrating. In fact, the entire day of his inauguration was spent celebrating Trump's departure by salivating over Joe Biden and even expressing joy over former presidents Bush, Obama, and Clinton, who were also in attendance. This hysteria in the media manifested itself with several reporters referring to this reunion of war criminals as some sort of superhero event.
The sight of the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas, you know, the Avengers, you know, sort of the Marvel superheroes back up there together, all in one place.
It's frankly amazing how quickly the media forgets that these are the same presidents who started the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and ruined the lives of millions of people. After this performance was finally over, the first thing Biden did as president was sign a slew of executive orders. Among them, rejoining the Paris Climate Accords, as well as the World Health Organization, which Trump had pulled out of. He reversed a few other decisions made by Trump, like the controversial Muslim ban that Trump introduced in 2017. However, what the media doesn't tell you is that this original law was crafted under Obama's presidency when Joe Biden was vice president. The Visa Waiver Program Improvement and Terrorist Trial Prevention Act of 2015. This is the framework that was introduced by the Obama administration, listing countries like Iran, Syria, Iraq, Sudan as areas of concern and safe havens for terrorists, and placing hurdles for anyone who's visited these countries. Trump, of course, built on that to ban dual nationals entirely, which Biden did roll back, but he hasn't gotten rid of the original legislation from 2015, which singles out these very same countries. Now, absent among any of Biden's first moves are the $2,000 stimulus checks. We heard repeatedly throughout his presidential campaign and from Democratic candidates and politicians that as soon as Biden is elected, Americans will get $2,000 stimulus checks.
We will be able to pass $2,000 stimulus checks for the people next week.
If you send John and the Reverend to Washington, those $2,000 checks will go out the door, restoring hope and decency and honor for so many people who are struggling right now.
Well, those checks still haven't arrived. As a matter of fact, Joe Biden has tried knocking them down to $1,400, claiming that the $600 issued under Trump a few months ago is to be counted as a part of that. It's frankly mind-boggling to see the president of the richest country in the world rob his own citizens in such a way during both the pandemic and economic crisis. And even then, those checks are still no closer to being sent out or anywhere near enough, and not retroactive. Now, in terms of healthcare, throughout his campaign, again, Joe Biden would say that healthcare is a human right. And keep in mind, we have millions of Americans that are unemployed, so they've also lost their health insurance as a result of that. Now, Joe Biden isn't saying that healthcare is a human right anymore. He's saying he wants to give Americans easier access to healthcare. Joe Biden has signed two executive actions, reopening enrollment for the Affordable Care Act until May. This is, again, a largely performative gesture and does not guarantee healthcare. Even if one were to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, most Americans can't afford the deductibles or out-of-pocket payments required for the insurance to kick in, making this effectively useless and leaving millions of Americans still underinsured. Biden's campaign promise to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour also seems to be out the window. with Democrats now introducing legislation aiming to push for this in the year 2025. Keep in mind, the Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. And this is the best they can do? It's frankly shameful, and will leave a large portion of the working class in a dismal state with growing resentment towards Washington. Once again, we're seeing the same behavior during the Obama years when Democrats had a supermajority and refused to do anything of substance with it. Now, in terms of foreign policy, we've had some interesting developments. As expected, Joe Biden's appointee for Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, was approved by the Senate and is now the first black man to ever lead the Pentagon. Austin is another familiar face from the Obama era, serving as the head of U.S. Central Command, which oversaw things like the intervention in Syria and the occupation of Iraq. Another part of his resume that the media seems to gloss over so often is the fact that Austin sat on the board of weapons manufacturer Raytheon, which is one of the largest contractors to the U.S. military. This conflict of interest didn't seem to matter to the Senate, which overwhelmingly voted to approve him, 93-2. Once again, bipartisanship in all things war and empire. Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had his confirmation hearing in the Senate. During a four-hour session, he was asked about a wide array of topics covering China, Venezuela, Iran, and more. Blinken, who served under Obama as Deputy Secretary of State and supported the regime change conquests in Libya and Syria, was grilled by Senator Rand Paul over his support for these failed imperialist endeavors.
Why do the wars continue? Why do the wars in Syria and Libya and Somalia and Afghanistan continue? Because the more things change, the more they stay the same. Mr. Blinken has been a full-throated advocate of military intervention in the Middle East.
Safe to say, when Joe Biden claims diversity and the media class and political class are breathing a sigh of relief, claiming a return to normalcy, their meaning of normal constitutes the same failed policies that resulted in the displacement and the deaths of countless innocents. That's what it really comes down to. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me to talk more is Rania Khalik, journalist and producer of Soapbox and Unauthorized Disclosure. It's great to have you on, Rania. Thanks for taking the time.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks for inviting me, Richard.
So Joe Biden is now president. He's been inaugurated. On his first day, he signs a bunch of executive orders, and he rejoins the Paris Climate Accords, the World Health Organization. So he reverses some of Trump's policies. Do you think he could have done more, however, especially for the working class in the United States?
100%. I mean, what he should have done is he should have come into office, and the first thing he should have done was immediately get out relief checks for people. That should have been his first priority. Was right away, and that's, he campaigned on that. A week before he was elected, he was saying, it's on video, get us elected, get the Democrats, get us in the Senate in Georgia, and we're going to get you $2,000 checks. Democrats were campaigning on that issue. And now, you know, we're back to negotiating maybe $1,400, maybe we'll have it by March. And I was expecting this. You know, Biden is your kind of typical centrist right-wing Democrat. He is doing exactly what Democrats do, which is the very, very least. The very, very least they can get away with. And, you know, there are some good things that we should be happy about. Like, of course, he overturned some of Trump's more draconian policies with regard to, for example, the Muslim ban. But, you know, he was also applauded for ending private prisons. Well, he didn't actually end private prisons. He signed an executive order that ended Justice Department contracts with private prisons, but also that's just a reversion to what happened under Obama. So it was just undoing something that Trump had done. You know, I think one of the more alarming aspects of his incoming administration on the domestic front has been really trying to ramp up fear around this new domestic war on terror and trying to get support for the idea of more anti-terrorism legislation, which we don't need in the U.S. I mean, we already have enough laws on the books in the U.S. to put all of us in jail for thinking the wrong things at this point after 20 years of this endless war on terror. The last thing we need is more laws like that. There's already plenty of laws on the books to deal with what we have known for more than a decade now is one of the biggest threats in America, which is the rise of the far-right violence. The U.S. is in an economic crisis right now. People are facing economic ruin. The COVID virus is still completely out of control. And obviously, he's only been in office for like a week or so. But still, I mean, there should be way more measures being taken to try and help people. Or you know what? They're going to have way more riots in the streets, you know, after a few more months or another year of this.
I'm sure you enjoyed the confirmation hearing of Austin Lloyd, who's now the first Black Secretary of Defense, or Secretary of State Blinken. What did you make of those? Because, you know, in terms of policy, it's not really that diverse. These are the same people who support a regime change and intervention in Syria and Libya, and they're given job promotions and cabinet positions, and they're rewarded for supporting these horrible policies under Obama.
Well, you know, in order to qualify for being a part of the foreign policy establishment in the U.S., you have to support all those wars. I mean, if you watch this confirmation hearing, actually, I know you did because you were commenting on it yourself. I mean, it was just like it wasn't even a question and answer session. It was like an interrogation by the neocons who run foreign policy in Washington, D.C., some of the most belligerent ones. He had to sit there and basically submit to and bow down to the most warmongering stances proposed by Lindsey Graham. And he was happy to, because he actually agrees with those people. It's not like he was really pretending. He actually agrees with the things that he said. I mean, he was pro-regime change, pro-recognizing Juan Guaido, pro-sanctions on Venezuela that are killing 40,000 people a year. You know, he was pro-ramping up the Cold War with China. He was, you know, he repeatedly bragged about his support for arming the right-wing neo-Nazis in Ukraine, though that's not how he says it. I mean, the list goes on, one thing after another. And, you know, even on Iran, I will say that's probably the one point of difference between a Biden administration and a Trump administration that's quite drastic, is the desire to go back to the Iran nuclear deal, mostly because people like Anthony Blinken were involved with helping negotiate it. So it's like near and dear to their hearts. They have like an emotional attachment to it. But at the same time, when it comes to Iran, even though that's a difference between them, at the same time, the same underlying narrative about Iran remains the same between these two parties. Mike Pompeo and Anthony Blinken are very difficult to tell apart when they're actually talking about Iran, because they say the same exact things.
Right. I saw Blinken's first press briefing, and he essentially said that he wants Iran to take the first step towards the JCPOA. I'm confused by that, because the United States is the one who left the deal. Shouldn't the U.S. be the first to show some goodwill, some good faith in re-entering the deal first?
Well, that would be logical, right? And that's what's funny, is you see these pronouncements coming out of the Biden administration about how, yeah, Iran has to go back to the deal first. And it's like, you're the one who broke the deal. Like, it was you. The Trump administration, not only did they break the deal, they over and over and over repeatedly committed acts of aggression and provocations for war. They killed Iran's top general on foreign soil. That's unprecedented. Like, you don't do that. They broke, I mean, and the U.S. behaved like a rogue state completely. And the sanctions, I mean, if some more powerful country came along and implemented sanctions on the U.S. the way the U.S. has implemented on Iran, the U.S. would nuke them. Because that's an act of war. Putting a country under economic siege like that is an act of war. So it's completely outrageous for anybody in the Biden administration to think they have the upper hand morally whatsoever, or are in any kind of position to be telling Iran that you're the one who has to make concessions first.
We're seeing that Robert Malley, who's the lead negotiator on the JCPOA, on the Iran nuclear deal, apparently a lot of Zionists and pro-Israel people seem to be against him. I mean, we know from the get-go that Netanyahu and such, they opposed the deal, but they seem to have a particular issue with Malley. Why is that the case?
Because when Robert Malley was inside of the Obama administration, he was a voice of reason when it came to not just Iran. He was a voice of reason when it came to the war in Syria and when it came to Libya. And basically, he was an obstacle to the, like, neoconservative designs for the Middle East, because not only did he have these viewpoints that he would then, in his advisory role to the president, you know, express, but he also acted as somebody who connected the White House to back channels between these countries that the Israelis and the neocons in the U.S. want the U.S. to destroy. So that's why he also plays an important role, because his time working for the International Crisis Group, you know, that's not, it's a you know, non-governmental organization that has those contacts within these different governments the U.S. doesn't talk to, which is why it makes him an important figure like that, you know what I mean? So this is why somebody like Robert Malley, I mean, he can make or break a war if he's able to bring, you know, the right messages and right people to an administration that maybe wants to start one or has some people in it that wants to start one. And he did play that role during the Obama administration. There was, you know, especially after the rise of ISIS in Syria, there was times when Robert Malley was able to connect, you know, to like serve as like this intermediary between these back channels to de-escalate, you know, the tensions between Syria and the U.S., which the U.S. started to change its positions to some degree after the rise of ISIS because they didn't want ISIS taking over the entire region. But, you know, neocons did. So it's also, I think, the, you know, the attacks on Robert Malley are also the Israel lobby and, you know, the neoconservative think tanks and that kind of segment of the establishment. It's their way of putting a red line. It's like, if they fight something as small as just one advisor, you know, it's kind of putting a line in the sand of, okay, then the Biden administration is going to be less likely to cross that later. So it's also just making themselves be heard and just trying to get in the way. You know, they're desperate. They really don't want to return to the Iran nuclear deal. They want a war with Iran. And so this is also their way of trying to make sure that somebody who might be able to stop it isn't there.
In terms of Yemen, the Treasury Department, they issued a license and suspended sanctions for about 1 month. We also saw a last-minute arms sale to the UAE and Saudi Arabia was paused for review. Do you think there's some sort of rift in terms of support for Saudi Arabia, or is this just symbolism, just for show?
So far, I don't see anything beyond symbolism, and it's yet to be seen. Yemen is one place where there may be a change in policy, I hope there is, because it would definitely prevent a lot of suffering if there were a change in policy in terms of overturning sanctions. As far as the U.S. relationship with the Emiratis and the Saudis, I mean, at the end of the day, it's actually quite normal for an incoming administration to pause any arms agreements after like that were made under a previous administration. That's not abnormal. That's not out of the ordinary. And you know, the U.S. I don't think the U.S. is going to change its entire relationship with these people in the Middle East. These are its allies. It's not going to change overnight. So I really think it's again, like when it comes to Democrats, you get a lot of symbolism. I do think in the long term, you may see a deterioration in the relationship with the Saudis moving forward, because that's more because the U.S. is shifting away from the Middle East slowly, but it is shifting away from the Middle East being sort of the center of its foreign policy strategy making. The U.S. for the future is much more interested in great power competition with Russia and China, particularly China. You know, something like 2/3 of U.S. naval assets are actually in Asia and surrounding China.
Wow.
So, you know, it's I don't think this is necessarily because a Democrat came into office. I think it has more to do with the fact that liberals, Democrats, they do empire better and they're more effective at it. And this already had started under Obama, and they're just kind of continuing the sort of the trajectory of U.S. foreign policy that existed at the end of the Obama administration that got slightly disrupted by Trump, but not really that much. And part of that is shifting away from the Middle East a little bit.
You know, Biden is continuing Trump's policy stealing the oil in Syria. We're also seeing an uptick of attacks from Daesh, a double suicide bombing in Baghdad, and these bus ambushes in Syria. Do you think this is going to be used as some kind of excuse to keep troop deployments there or increase them maybe?
That's a great question. I think, you know, I can't tell the future, but I think what's most likely is that those kinds of things will be used as justifications to keep the remaining troop presence that America has. The troop presence in Syria is accomplishing the goal of making sure that the Syrian government can't access its own oil. And the U.S. presence in Iraq is accomplishing the goal of basically acting as a barrier between Iraq and Syria. That's what that's the whole purpose of that, is to keep these countries from connecting with each other. A continuation of what saw happening under the Obama administration, which was more of a reliance on small special operations units and specialized groups of troops rather than large troop presences as our way of like doing empire now.
In the last month, unfortunately, the rest of the Middle East has continued to see destabilization and unrest. There has been an unusual uptick in attacks by Daesh. In December, we saw a horrific ambush take place in the Syrian desert near Palmyra, where dozens were killed. This was followed by another bus attack in Syria in January. In Baghdad, there was a double suicide bombing, which left over 30 dead and scores of wounded. And the latest in Iraq, 12 fighters from the Hashd al-Sha'bi, or PMF, were killed in another ambush by Daesh. Now, some speculate that the recent rise in attacks by Daesh could be used as another excuse by the United States to maintain its forever presence in the Middle East, occupying Syria's oil and occupying Iraq as a buffer with Iran. In many ways, much remains the same and business as usual. We've seen Israel continue its regular bombing of Syria absolutely unchecked, killing a family of four just the other day. Not a word of condemnation from the international community or the new administration. Within one day of Biden's inauguration, Syria's Sana news agency reported that a U.S. convoy of 40 trucks had entered Syria illegally through the Al-Walid border crossing with Iraq. These convoys have been a regular occurrence, as Trump has been busy stealing the oil, which he shamelessly admitted.
We're keeping the oil. We have the oil. The oil is secure. We left troops behind only for the oil.
This was confirmed in late 2020 during a Senate hearing between Senator Lindsey Graham and former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that a U.S. corporation, Delta Crescent Energy, would be plundering Syria's oil in a deal with the Kurdish-led SDF. Bashar al-Jafari, Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, sent a clear message to the U.N. Security Council saying that the new U.S. administration must stop acts of aggression and occupation plundering the wealth of my country, withdraw its occupying forces from it, and stop supporting separatist militias, illegal entities, and attempts to threaten Syria's sovereignty, unity, and territorial integrity. Now, one area where it looks like there might be some hope, however small, is Yemen. We saw how the Trump administration on its way out designated Yemen's Houthi movement as a foreign terrorist organization, or FTO, slapping Yemen with sanctions. Yemen has been gripped by war, famine, and disease since the Saudi-led coalition began its war against the country in 2015, with support and arms sales from the U.S. and its allies. 80% of Yemenis live in Houthi-controlled areas. Now, the United Nations calls what's happening there the worst humanitarian crisis in the world and says that if these sanctions are not removed immediately, we could see the worst famine in decades. During his presidential campaign, Biden said that he would end U.S. support for the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen. So far, we've seen a few developments in that direction. The State Department under Blinken has launched a review of the former Trump administration's terrorist designation of Yemen's Houthi movement, or Ansar Allah. The Office of Foreign Assets Control under the Treasury Department has issued a temporary license that exempts Ansar Allah from sanctions. However, this license only lasts 1 month until February 26th, 2021. While this seems like a step in the right direction, 1 month might not be enough to convince traders, suppliers, and banks to continue operating in Yemen. More importantly, this doesn't fix the original problem, which is the terrorist designation itself. While, of course, 1 week might seem too early to judge a presidency, let's not forget that Joe Biden and his cabinet have been in government for most of their lives and vehemently supported a lot of these failed policies that caused these problems in the first place. Secretary of State Blinken, Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Joe Biden himself, these are all people who supported intervention in Syria, Libya, Yemen, Iraq, and have given unconditional support to Israel and Saudi Arabia. We know what their records are, and we know they're cut from the same cloth. Fixing the problems they helped start is the bare minimum. Needless to say, I'd love to be proven wrong and actually see some concrete steps taken in the right direction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Duties of a Scholar. Brothers and sisters, we know Islamic scholars are, spread out throughout the world. Now, what are their duties? What are the expectations from Islamic scholars? We refer to the khutbah of Mina, the sermon of Mina of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this is where we find a lot of guidelines and a lot of instructions for the Islamic scholars to follow. Imam Hussein alayhi salam says to the Islamic scholars, right? You have taken lightly your duties as leaders. You have neglected the rights of the oppressed and lowly, but have assiduously pursued what you regard as your personal rights. You have not spent your money or risked your life for the sake of the one who gave you life, nor have you fought against any group or tribe for the sake of God. Nevertheless, you desire and regard it as your due that he should grant you paradise, the company of the Prophet, and security from chastisement in the hereafter. You have such expectations of God. I fear that the full weight of his wrath descends upon you, for although it is by his might and glory that you have achieved high rank, you show no respect to those who truly know God, while you yourselves enjoy respect among God's creatures on his account. Brothers and sisters, these are the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He is laying it out for us. Those scholars who are not fulfilling their Islamic obligations and their duties the way they're expected to being a scholar, this is for them. They need to listen to the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and based on it, act. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the duties of a scholar in the light of the sermon of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam says to the scholars, I am also afraid for you for another reason. You see the covenant enacted with God being violated and trampled underfoot, yet you show no anxiety. When it comes to the covenants enacted with your fathers, you become greatly disturbed and anxious if they are only violated in part. But the pledges you have given to the most noble messenger, and they are a matter of complete indifference to you. Again, who is Imam Hussein alayhi salam talking to? He is talking to Islamic scholars. Do we not see that many Islamic scholars, unfortunately, in today's time and age, are not fulfilling their duties and responsibilities? Imam Hussein alayhi salam is reminding them of what they're expected to be doing. The blind, the dumb, and chronically ill everywhere lack protection in towns, and no mercy is shown to them. But you neither behave in accordance with your function and rank, nor you support or pay any regard to those who do. You purchase your safety from the oppressive ruling powers with flattery, cajolery, and compromise. Brothers and sisters, this is again Imam Hussein alayhi salam telling the Islamic scholars what they're doing and what they're not doing. Now, of course, there are many Islamic scholars who are fulfilling their responsibilities out there. You know, people like Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, people like Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. There are many other people from all over the world who are Islamic scholars, and they are fulfilling their responsibilities. You know, one of the brightest names we have today is Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. So, you know, if you look at all of them, they are carrying out their responsibilities. But what about rest of the ummah? Where is rest of the ummah? Do they not have any responsibilities, all these scholars throughout the world? What is their role? What are they doing? This is something for us to contemplate, and more than us, it is something for the Islamic scholars to think about. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.